Kimball.com. This is Downtown.
Man, it got a little better last night for the Red Sox, although, Cooperstown's not calling for the tape of last night's game. They did get a win, though. More on that coming up a little bit later. Welcome into Downtown. On a Thursday afternoon, next to last day of the month of July, the 2,254th Downtown broadcast. Rich Kimball here, along with Kerry Haskell. We're brought to you this afternoon and every day by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Coming up on the show today, a lengthy conversation with actor Gavin McLeod as we continue to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Mary Tyler Moore Show. He'll look back on his role as Murray Slaughter, but we'll talk a little Love Boat and more with him. Jabron Graham with Downtown Weekend and some beer talk on the Three Pint Stance with Tim Bissell of Bandit Brewing. But we get things underway this afternoon by welcoming back to the show the author of a number of books, including Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty, Crazy Good, The True Story of Dan Patch, the Most Famous Horse in America, Blood and Smoke, and a brand new one that is just terrific, Butch Cassidy, The True Story of an American Outlaw. Charles Learson joins us this afternoon. Charles, thanks so much for coming back with us.
My pleasure, Rich. Glad to be here.
Love this book so much, and I'm curious that you've written an awful lot about sports. What led you from sports into the outlaw world?
Well, it was a simple thing of being stuck for a new subject, and my editor at Simon & Schuster suggested Butch Cassidy, and I didn't know anything about the Wild West or Western Outlaws other than, you know, watch a lot of TV and movies and saw the original Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid movie, which is now 51 years old, hard to believe.
Ouch.
So I was starting from kind of like a standing start, and but I do love it did play into one of my passions, which is this period of history between 1880 roughly and the roughly also the First World War. There's so much that happened in America then. I think that's the most transformative and important period in American history. You know, as big as the digital age is, and as it certainly as important as, you know, the advent of the cell phone and the computer and all that, I think that period was more interesting and more important because you had the automobile, you had the movies, you had electricity in cities, and you had everything that went with it. You had an explosion of literacy where most people could read by the end of that period in America, the vast majority. And at the beginning of that time span, a minority of Americans could read. So, you know, it was a move from the cities to the countries, from the farms, I mean, to the cities. And what happened with Butch Cassidy was he was at the very tail end of that Wild West era. And it was getting harder and harder to be an American outlaw. And that had a great appeal to me, that idea.
Well, in Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty, you corrected a lot of misperceptions and outright lies about Cobb. And, of course, when you talk about outlaws and figures from the Old West, they're always shrouded in mystery and confusion and fiction. The old line from The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, you know, report the legend. And certainly there were a lot about Butch Cassidy, starting with his very persona. He was not Butch Cassidy. He was not George Cassidy, but Bob Parker, a Mormon whose family had made their way west from New York City.
New York City had a brief stopover in New York on their way from England, where they were recruited by the Mormons, who had a big missionary movement out in England, and brought in thousands of people, among them Butch Cassidy's future parents. And they made their way out to Utah, which was Brigham Young was stocking Utah with believers in the Mormon faith to start this separate colony that he was going to start out there. That was going to be even apart from America, something like within America, but also outside of America. And Butch was born there in 1866. He was born, as you say, Robert Leroy Parker, to very poor farmers, ranchers. And that was the very beginning. Southern Utah is a very tough place just to survive and live between the weather conditions and the relations between the Indians and the settlers. It was a really hard place to live. And I think he developed this persona of Butch Cassidy. It was almost like a form of entertainment. He was almost like an entertainer more than an outlaw. And if that sounds like I'm making light of law-breaking, I'm not as much as you think, perhaps, because Butch played by these rules where he was not a brutal criminal. He didn't kill anyone or harm them. And he didn't even harm average people financially. He was after the money that was in the safe. When he'd rob a train or a bank, people would get scared. They'd hold out their watches and their wallets, and they'd say, "Take this, please." And he'd say, "No, we don't want your money. We want what's in the corporate safe." So that's what he was a bedeviler of the corporations that were making life even harder out west.
And as you explained, he didn't kill, but he used the appearance of ruthlessness, but also a professionalism in the way he and eventually the members of the Wild Bunch would dress.
Exactly. That was one of the more interesting things I found, actually, that they would go out of their way to dress well, him and his gang, the Wild Bunch, and always be bathed and well barbered and groomed, and to convey an air of professionalism, that they weren't fools and they weren't bumbling idiots or desperate men. They were calm professionals, and so that way they minimized violence when they got to the bank window, when they got to the train safe, and or whatever they were robbing, because they were professionals and they had this professional air, and they did have an air of cold-heartedness that went with it that was meant to intimidate, but the intimidation was all a substitute for the violence. And there's cases on the record of the newspapers covered it, the more believable newspapers of people who were robbed, that Butch admonished his gang members, don't hurt that guy, you know, don't watch out, you're gonna kill him, and always pulled their punches, always pulled up short, because as I say, he was as much of an entertainer as he was an outlaw.
We're talking with Charles Learson here on Downtown. When you wonder why someone would choose the outlaw life, well, a couple of reasons. As you point out, some past books and films about this time period and the West really romanticized it. It was not like Little House on the Prairie by any stretch. It was a hard life. And I love a phrase that you use, that cowboy crap gets old fast.
That's right. I mean, the West is, of course, beautiful. And we go out there just to absorb the scenery nowadays. But it was also an extremely boring place to live, especially, and to work. If you were a young man, a cowboy, and you were part of this generation, as Butch was, the sort of the post-Civil War generation, he was born in 1866, and it was a hard life and a boring life. And the boringness of it, the repetitiveness of it, and the just to go from here to there, you know, would take was the work of weeks. You know, we think of riding between two cities, but that took a week of sleeping outside, and if you were on the back of the ranch, it was even more boring. You were shoveling horse manure and doing God knows what. So it was an escape. For a lot of outlaws, it was. For Butch, it was. A stylish escape, more of a stylish escape than for some other guys.
Most of what we think we know about Butch comes, of course, from the movie. And as you point out, William Goldman did minimal research because, well, bad boys trump good history. He wanted the story.
Right. He had great instincts for what made a Hollywood movie. And I went into read William Goldman's papers, and he's the guy that wrote Sting and a bunch of other very famous and entertaining movies. I went to look through his papers there at Columbia University, and there's a folder there for Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and there's one of the very few things in it is a comic book from the 1950s about Butch Cassidy, and there's a couple of scraps of paper, but that's it. He said he didn't want to be confined by the facts, and that's typical Hollywood in a way. You know, like they'd rather have that. They had a good name, Butch Cassidy, Sundance Kid, two good names, and they'll make up a story to go with it. And so the, you know, most of the movie starts out with this, people may remember if they've seen it recently, it starts out with this thing, you know, most of what follows is true. But it's actually not, that's not true at all. But the one thing they got right was Butch's personality. And William Goldman by accident, and Paul Newman, who did even less research than William Goldman and played Butch in the movie, they captured Butch's personality.
And style was a big part of it, too, including his first adult bank robbery and his means of escape and the way he got onto his horse.
He was, well, you know, one of the other things he was responsible for was perfecting this system of putting a horse relay out there to, and it would take weeks of work and to round up the horses, to train them. So he'd have horses staked, and then he'd have to have guys watching the horses, him and the gang, and they would ride a few miles and switch to fresh horses and so on and so forth. And because in those days, you know, once you robbed the bank or robbed the railroad, it was a horse race between you and the posse. So by changing horses every few miles, it was no competition, and you just rode away from them. But I think what maybe what you're referring to was the time when they robbed the bank, and Bush decided he, just for being purposes of being stylish and show busy, he was going to leap on his horse from the rear, not get up in the stirrup. And it took weeks of practice, and he had to do it under the conditions for, so the horse was right in the middle of town. He couldn't do it out in the, you know, in some remote area. He had to have the horse practice where it was a bustling, busy street, and he would then leap on into the saddle from the rear. When the time came, he pulled it off, but he lost his hat in the process. His hat flew off, and for a cowboy, that was a major faux pas, because those guys never took their hats off.
There are so many wonderful characters in the book. One of my favorites is a historian, I guess I should put that in quotation marks. Can you talk a little bit about Cary Ross Boren?
Yeah, he's an interesting guy that I met. You know, one of the things that happened when the movie came out in 1969 was that it spurred, and no pun intended, this tremendous amount of interest in sort of hobbyists research. Doing, people would, for kind of a hobby, they'd investigate Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, because very little was known about them. They had kind of fallen into obscurity by the time the movie came out. They weren't like Jesse James or Billy the Kid. People weren't talking about them. And then the movie came out and people said, well, who are these guys? So a lot of people got involved in digging up stuff about them. And some people, to stay ahead of the pack, well, Cary Ross Boren is a guy who originally was on the kind of the A-list of researchers. He was a consultant on the movie. He helped Robert Redford, who played the Sundance Kid. He helped him a few years later when Redford wrote a book called The Outlaw Trail and rode the trail and all. But then Mr. Boren he kind of drove off into the loco weed, and he started making up stories about how Butch Cassidy and, you know, they'd met Lawrence of Arabia. You know, they met Pancho Villa, and they lived until the 1940s or 50s and died in Nevada. He's actually the leader of a school of like of very eccentric and dubious researchers that's still out there.
There were so many patterns to his life. And one is this, that, he would peak, they would do well after a bank job, then he would go broke, and then Butch would consider going back to the straight life. And there seemed to always be that push and pull with him, with people in the straight life often pulling for him to do well and make the right choice.
Yeah, he his life is a series of, as you say, like, you know, his pendulum swings. He didn't commit dozens and dozens of robberies, because a lot of the time he was in the mood and trying to go straight. When he was going straight and trying to make a living as a rancher, he'd get discouraged and bored and yearn for the exciting outlaw life. And then he'd become an outlaw and he'd get tired of being chased and tired of a life where you couldn't sit with your back to the door and you had to worry every minute about being caught. And those guys really worried, because prisons were really tough places to be in those days out in the West. And a lot of them, you know, killed themselves rather than get caught and go to prison. So Butch would swing back and forth between yearning for the grass was always greener. And in fact, when they finally made their big move to South America in 1901, it was because they were sick of being pursued and they wanted to start the ranching life again and start it up again. So they went to Argentina. It's a chapter that's left out of the movie. In the movie, they just go to Bolivia, but in reality, they went to Argentina, Chile, Bolivia, and they bounced around down there and were legit ranchers in Argentina for 5 years.
I think one of my favorite stories in the book is the Outlaws' Thanksgiving in 1896.
Yeah, that's the first recorded instance we have of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid together. One reason the book is mostly about Butch Cassidy and it's called Butch Cassidy is because he was sort of the dominant figure, and he didn't connect with Sundance until pretty late in their careers. But when the first time we have on record of them being in the same place, it was on this place called Browns Park, which is kind of where near where Colorado meets Wyoming, or it's in a really an obscure place. And I went there, but it was known as a place where outlaws could go, and the regular folks, the regular ranchers would turn their cheek and not turn them in. And so all the outlaws were there, and they had this big Thanksgiving feast full of outlaws and full of the prominent people from Browns Park in 1896. And at one point the doors flew open and there was Butch and Sundance. They came out, they were the waiters, and they had gravy boats. And, you know, Thanksgiving then I found out was pretty much what it is now, the same dishes and the same rituals and whatnot. And there they had the turkey and the cranberry sauce and the gravy and the mashed potatoes and the stuffing. And they were doing their best to act like, you know, French waiters in a fancy restaurant. And everyone in this remote area was dressed up, with the men with the stiff high collars and the women with the long frilly dresses, because everyone had set of clothes like that, because they would get their picture taken every once in a while, every few years when a traveling photographer went around. So it was de rigueur to have a fancy outfit. So they put those on and they had this party. And, you know, that's one of the things that William Goldman missed by not doing some more research, because that's not in the movie. And it sounds like it would have been a great scene in the movie with Butch and Sundance coming out and serving Thanksgiving dinner.
And speaking of the movie, the Elsie Lay is a character that it seems from the book is closer to Butch than Harry Lanabas, Sundance, ever was. A great story about the grandchildren of Elsie Lay and others going to see the movie and the reaction when somebody said to him, yeah, that's Sundance, it seems more like your grandfather than it does Harry.
That's right. And it was, the guy's name was Harvey Murdoch. I spoke to him. He was Elsie Lay's grandson. And he said, well, yeah, I know what you mean, but who would go to see a movie called Butch Cassidy and Elsie Lay? You know, so he had a sense of what looked better on a marquee. It's funny because that story reminds me also of how close the Wild West was. It's not all that long ago, because when the movie came out, not just Elsie Lay's, that's Butch's real best friend, his grandson was still alive, and he'd met his grandfather a few times. So I talked to a guy who talked to a guy who was Butch's, I've met a guy who talked to someone who was Butch's best friend, but also Butch's sister was still alive. One of his sisters, when the movie came out, I say in the book, alive and kicking, because she didn't get any money from Hollywood. and she was very angry about that. And she went and wrote her own book a long time ago. But Butch had 13 siblings, and so some of them were born quite a long time after him and were still alive in 1969.
And you went to all these places. You traveled to South America. You went to the cabin where he grew up, which was also the scene of a huge massacre not long before his birth.
Yeah, it was a few miles from there. Yeah, the story of the Mormon settlement is I don't want to get into criticizing religions, but it's a rough thing, because Mormons we think of Mormons as Donnie and Marie and Mitt Romney and very calm, sophisticated, civilized people, but in the 19th century they were kind of dedicated to the overthrow of the United States government. And they were waiting for the Civil War to end, the Mormons in Utah, and then attack the United States government and take over and turn it into a theocracy. That was their plan. So it was kind of a wild scene in a way out there, and very tense. The relationship between the government and the Mormons was a very tense and was one long standoff there. at the time when Butch was around.
Well, if you think you know the story of Butch Cassidy, I'm pretty sure you don't, but you will if you read Butch Cassidy, the true story of an American outlaw, including an ending very different from the movie, far less ambiguous. And but you got to read the book to find out about that. Charles, loved it. A tremendous read. It's great to talk with you once again. We wish you much success with the book.
Thank you, Rich. I really appreciate it. It's been fun.
Charles Learson with us on Downtown. It's 25 minutes after 4 o'clock. Still to come, Tim Bissell, the three-pint stance straight ahead. Jabron Graham,